Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it is Tuesday, September 2nd. So let's work with our online materials just a little bit. So what do we need to go online? We need a browser, right? We need to boot a program up called a browser, an internet browser, and the one that works really well is Internet Explorer. And probably some other programs would work just fine, though I usually check out all the websites in Internet Explorer. So some features may or may not work in Firefox or other kinds of browsers that you have. All right. So I don't have my website in favorites right here, and I'm not sure I even know what the address is. So I'm going to log into Blackboard, and hopefully I'll have a message from myself saying where this stuff is. And the keyboard is not working. Okay. Let's try this keyboard. Good. All right, don't forget, turn off your cell phones. All right, so you should have gotten an email that looks like this right here. Now my mouse isn't working. Ay, ay, ay. I'll have to join you way over here in the corner. All right, here's the email I sent you, and here's the link. All right, so you just click on this link, and this is, now you're out of Blackboard. You're at this site right here. So what is it? It's not www, it's just Cypress College. Oh, that's not right. It's embedded in Blackboard. It just loaded this page in there. All right, well, nonetheless, it will take you to this page. And here's the first lecture. Right? And you can either click, you can left-click on it, which is a regular mouse button click, and it will play in whatever media player that you have enabled in your computer. Most people have Windows Media Player, but you got Real Player or other kinds of players. It will start playing it. And it's really nice because it's just random access. You can skip automatically from one point of a lecture to beginning to end without any difficulty. And then if you have a hearing deficit, you can actually read along, right? Because there you see underneath it the Word file that's a transcript, but it's from a different semester. It's from a previous semester, so the dates are going to be a little bit different, but the information content is the same. All right, so where the heck was this? Oh, holy cow. Something really funny is going on here. What about this mouse? Oh, great. Okay, this one is working. Okay, so I think my... I don't know. It's on your syllabus. Does anybody have a syllabus handy? SEM.Cypress. Okay. So it is SEM.CypressCollege.edu/TildeJGober. That's it. Okay, so this is where the recordings are going to be. But that's the only thing that's going to be on this website, are the recordings, right? So everything else is going to be in Blackboard, your grades, everything else. So what class do you want? Something that looks like 241, right here. And so there's your textbook, and then you probably want the Tuesday, Thursday lectures, but if you want to listen to Monday, Wednesday, you're welcome to do that. So just click here Tuesday, Thursday, and then here are the lectures. So by left-clicking, which is the usual button that you use to click with, will open up the media player. Or if you want to download it to your computer, use the right-hand mouse button. And so if you want to use the right-hand mouse button, you click, then save target as, right? Save target as, and then it's going to ask you, where do you want to put it? Right? I'm going to cancel out because I don't want to clutter up this computer. But put it someplace in your computer, and then you can listen to it anytime without having to download it again or even getting on the internet. And it's a WAV file, so you can drag and drop it to your MP3 player or burn a CD and listen to it in a CD player if you want. Right, but that's up to you. All right, so this is the web page for that. All right, what else? Well, I was in Blackboard. Let's see if I got bonked out. And somebody had a question about downloading files. Oh, you're going to have to learn this picture one of these days. Let's see, course information, course documents, lecture PowerPoint slides. Okay, and so here again, you can right-click or left-click. Left-click is usually how you select a link. That will open up PowerPoint just in this frame of the internet page, but that's not a convenient way to print it out.
Oh, I see that. This is what came out.
That's really nice, but it takes one picture per page.
So how do you link it in?
Yeah, okay. Well, instead of doing that, use the right-hand mouse button. It's the one you usually don't use. It's the right-hand mouse button, and you'd say save target as, pick a place on your computer, and let's see, where would be a good place so where we can remember to delete it? Yeah? I'll just put it on the desktop. It'll clutter that up and I'll notice that it's not there. But it's a PowerPoint file, so we just say save, blah, 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 and it's downloaded already, pretty close, and now I'll just say open. So it's going to launch a PowerPoint program. Here's a PowerPoint program. And if you don't have a PowerPoint program, you can go to the internet and at least get a viewer program, Microsoft Windows Viewer program. But I don't know if it will let you format it to the way that I like to have it with four pictures per page. It's usually the PowerPoint program that you need to do that.
If you do it in Windows,
yeah?
If you go to Print Preview, there's a little space up top that says how many cells per page.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't know if that will work in the viewer program. But if you're in PowerPoint right now, this is a PowerPoint program. If you hit, like you said, if you hit File, I'm going to hit File right here. And then Print Preview. Okay. Maybe under Options. Yeah. So I like to hit Scale to Fit Paper. That makes it bigger, because the slides are pretty small already. And let's see, frame, I like a frame around the slides, that's fine. Okay, and I think I like this presentation of the slides as opposed to on the piece of paper that's up big like that. Okay, and then if you hit print, you get this little menu, and say handouts. And then for handouts, you can select how many you want per page. So four seems to be good for me. And you can see now how it's going to come out on the piece of paper. And, you know, you can change some of these. You can also hit select to fit paper on this window as well. And then you could hit OK. But I don't know if there's a printer anywhere. So I'm not going to hit OK. Or it might go someplace I don't want it to go. So, like to the president's office. So I'm not going to hit OK. Okay, so we'll just hit cancel. But now this program is on your computer, and you can print it out any kind of different way you want. But I wouldn't print it in color if I were. I would just print it in black and white. If you have a color printer, select black and white only in one of these menus here, because it's just way too expensive to do that. All right, so that's the latest and greatest for things. Anybody have any questions? No? Okay. Okay, and I gave you study materials on ARIS. I think I had a question about how to get to ARIS. What does that look like? Uh-oh, what did I type? All right, so you go, this is the link. Oh, no, that's not it. This is a link that's in a bunch of almost every page in your textbook. So type that in, ARIS.MHHE, that probably stands for McGraw-Hill Higher Education. And that's going to take you to a totally different place. All right, so you don't have to type all this in. You can select your subject, which is what? Anatomy and Physiology. And then select your textbook, which is a 10th edition of Fox. And it will take you to this page right here. A lot of people were getting confused because they didn't have a username and password. But you don't need username and password, right? Just hit Resources. And when you hit Resources, you can then select a chapter. So I think Chapter 1 is going to be on the first test, right? And I have you do some quizzes, I think. All right, maybe some true-false. I don't ask you to do the crossword puzzle. Fill in the blanks, I think I ask you to do. Multiple choice, for sure. Oh, we did this last time. Yeah, okay. I don't know. I got another couple emails from people. So make sure that in the study guide that's on Blackboard, you know how to answer these questions. So this allows you to work with the material. It helps you develop a little familiarity and a way to think about the material. Okay, so that's where that is. All right. One other thing that's going to be on the test are chemicals. All right. Oh, okay. This is not exactly what I wanted to show you, so I'm going to stop this. I'll come back. Where's Goldberg? Oh, I see it. All right, so let's work with this for just a second. Maybe a little bit longer than a second. All right, so I'm going to show you a bunch of pictures, and I want you to tell me what's on that picture. Anybody need the sign-in sheet by any chance? Yeah. Here's the sign-in sheet. So what is this a picture of? The nothing. It's just a rest station. This just allows you to think. Okay, so that's why it sort of looks like a polar bear in a snowstorm. All right, so I'm going to show you a picture, and as fast as you can, you should tell me what you see. Because I want you to be able to recognize these chemicals, because these are exam figures from your study guide, and they could be on the test. Okay, so here is what a monophosphate, and there is this is a ribose sugar, and here's a base. This is a building block for RNA. So this is an RNA nucleotide, or a ribonucleotide. I know it's a ribonucleotide because there's an OH down here. Ribonucleotide. This is the basic building block of RNA. What's the basic building block of protein? Amino acid. So you're going to know what an amino acid looks like too. All right, so let's work on this a couple times. All right, so what kind of group is that? That's a sulfhydryl group. All right, sulfhydryl group. Rest station. And what is this? This is an amino group. And this is a carboxyl group. It's an acid because that proton can hop off and jump into solution and float around as a hydrogen ion. All right, and that's a phosphate group. So whenever we say phosphate or inorganic phosphate, is this group right here. It's a PO4. And this is also an acidic group because this hydrogen can jump off and this hydrogen can jump off and donate a proton to solution. So what's an acid? Can you tell me a definition of an acid once again? It's a chemical compound that donates a proton to the solution. So that's why this is an acid. It donates those protons to solution. All right, and what is this? That is a monosaccharide. It's a 6-carbon monosaccharide. It's probably glucose. Okay, so you'd say monosaccharide because it's a building block of what? Polysaccharides. Okay, so that's pretty simple. And this? Yeah, do you see this acidic group right here, the carboxyl group, and it's a big, long hydrocarbon chain? That's a fatty acid. And as a matter of fact, that's a saturated fatty acid, because at every carbon, there's a hydrogen atom. And that's nothing. And this one here, triglyceride formation. So here's the triglyceride. Here are three fatty acids. And this molecule here is glycerol. So glycerol is a building block of a triglyceride. And what is the name of this reaction? A dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, here is another monosaccharide. But this is fructose. Yeah, because it's a five-sided ring. And this? That's a micelle with, what's on the inside of that micelle?
Hydrophobic.
Yeah, but the name of this molecule right here, that's a phospho, the PO4, and then these two fatty acid chains, that's a lipid, phospholipid, right? That's a micelle made from phospholipids. And what we got here, is this a sugar, protein, lipid, or what? It's a lipid in particular. This one up here is cholesterol. And then here are some steroid hormones. You don't have to know the names of them, but anytime you see this bloop, 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 bloop like that, that should be a steroid or cholesterol, a lipid. And a rest station. And this one, carboxylic acid, long hydrocarbon chain. That's a fatty acid, but it's unsaturated fatty acid. Now, what is this guy? Here, what kind of group is this again? Amino group, and this is an acid, so this is what? An amino acid, by looking at it. And don't forget, this R can take many different forms, depending on exactly what kind of amino acid it is. All right, what's this? Phospholipid. This we didn't look at yet, but this is a fatty acid that's been folded on over on itself. That's a prostaglandin. Different kinds of prostaglandins. And this kind of looks like DNA, but not really. This is the secondary structure of a protein. This is the alpha helix of a protein, so I would say secondary structure. Other things that you could think here is, what determines a secondary structure? The primary structure, which is what? The sequence of amino acids in this long chain of amino acids. Okay, now what's this? Similar to that first one I showed you, but different. Yeah, this is a nucleotide, and this ribose right here is missing an oxygen, so we call that the deoxyribose, and it's a nucleotide that makes DNA. Deoxyribonucleotide, because it doesn't have this oxygen right here. Oops. All right. What's that functional group? That's a hydroxyl group, hydroxyl. And this is glycerol. And this is a carbonyl group. Now, we're at the beginning again. What is that? This is ribose, because it has that oxygen. So this is a ribonucleotide. Don't forget, a nucleotide's got a base, a sugar, and a phosphate. And this is a building block of what? This is a building block of DNA in particular, because it's RNA, because this is a ribonucleotide. All right, want to go a little faster? Yeah, not too much faster, just a little bit. What group was that? Sulfhydryl group. What group is that? Amino group. Okay, don't look at me. You're going to miss the slide. Look at the screen. Ready? What's that? Carboxyl group. Phosphate group. Ah, see how easy that's getting already? Monosaccharide. That's a monosaccharide, building block of polysaccharide or disaccharide. Here we go. Saturated fatty acid. It's a saturated fatty acid because it's really, really long. Amino acid is small. Yeah. Okay. All right, this one. Triglyceride formation by what kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis. Monosaccharide, that would be a good example of fructose, but monosaccharide. Micelle. Cholesterol and three steroid hormones. Unsaturated fatty acid. Amino acid. Amino acid. Phospholipid. Prostaglandin. Secondary structure. Yeah, you could say alpha helix, but secondary structure is probably a little bit better way of thinking about it. That was a deoxyribonucleotide, because it's missing the oxygen right here. Deoxyribonucleotide. Building block of DNA. Let's go back and look. Deoxyribo, that stands for DNA. And ribonucleic acids have the OH, that would be RNA. So that's how you put those together. Did we see this one already? Hydroxyl group. Glycerol, building block of a triglyceride. Carbonyl group, carbonyl. Ooh, that was fast. That was a ribonucleotide. Want to go back and look at it real quick? Ribonucleotide for RNA. It's a building block for RNA. All right. Sulfhydryl group. Amino group. Carboxyl group. Phosphate group. Monosaccharide. Saturated fatty acid. Triglyceride formation. Monosaccharide. Micelle. Oh, I showed that too long. Cholesterol or steroids or steroid hormones. Yeah. Saturated fatty acid. Amino acid. Phospholipid. Prostaglandins. Secondary structure. Secondary structure is the building block of what?
Primary.
Goes the other way. Tertiary structure. The building block of secondary structure is primary. But secondary is the building block of tertiary structure. Ready? Ooh. That was too fast. It was a nucleotide of some kind. It was a what? A deoxyribonucleotide for DNA. So on the real test, you'll have a lot more time to look at it. So it'll make it a lot easier. Hydroxyl group. Okay, I'm not going to say it anymore. You guys have to say it. Carbonyl group. Ribonucleotide. Ribonucleotide. It's a building block of RNA. Nucleotide. Ribonucleic acid. That was a ribonucleic acid because it had the OH right there. Okay. So that's, you guys, I think it's good to practice that. And on my website, which, did I close it already? I guess I did. Is it there? Okay, let's go back to Internet Explorer. Oh, I didn't save it as a bookmark. That's too bad. At least this keyboard is still working. Okay, so what is it? S-E-M dot Cypress. Oh, yeah, thank you, thank you. Yes, very good. Okay, here it is. Here's a chem flash quiz for you. Okay, so flash quiz means that the structures are just flashing in front of your eyes. All right, but I've loaded it with a movie maker program, and it's captioned, and you can hear my voice, And you can watch that if you want to practice your structures, even though you're not in class. Okay, and you can pause it, go back, forward, or whatever, okay, because it's like just like a newsreel, except it has chemicals in there. And I got some other flash quizzes like for anatomy and stuff, but maybe I'll put some more on there for you. You can try that. You'll need a Windows Media Player to see it, I think, will work just fine. All right, I don't want to take time now, but after class, maybe Thursday, you can look at it. All right. Okay, now before we leave, what do we want to do? Add. Okay, that should be there for next time then. Okay, so that's the flash quiz. All right, now we want to, what chapter are we on? 3? Cell structure, genetic control, bulk transport. All right, so the function of cilia and flagella are all motility, microvilli. Oh, we were talking about that last time. Slide 19? Okay, we're getting close. I just want to review just a little bit, and then you can ask me some questions. Microvilli increase absorption. And how do they increase absorption? What's the function, by what method do they use to increase absorption? Yeah, they increase the surface area, but in everyday language, what does surface area really mean? What one word? Doorway. Yeah, doorway. Okay, as the doorway gets bigger, more stuff can move across the cell membrane. Okay. Okay, so the cilia are for motility, microvilli, cytoplasmic organelles. Yeah, we talked about that. The cytoskeleton made up of microtubules, intermediate filaments, and microfilaments. They're anchored together. They're attached to the cell membrane to give the cell its shape. And can you tell me what organizes these microtubules? There's another organelle inside the cell that helps organize, and those are the centrioles, or the centrosome complex. And the centrioles and centrioles or centrosome complex is really made out of microtubules as well. And each one of these little microtubules right here can act as a little monorail. So organelles can hop on them and catch a ride to a different part of the cell, or a cell can make them move around and go to different places. Right, so you all know what a monorail is, right? Okay. So here's a pretty generalized picture of a cell. Mitochondria right here. They're important for generating ATP. They require oxygen to do that. Without oxygen, they can't make ATP. And what can you tell me about ATP? It's the energy molecule inside a cell. It's the energy currency. What's the energy molecule inside your car? Okay. Yeah, the molecule, the chemical, is really gasoline. In most of our cars, some of us might have a fancy car that uses hydrogen or electricity, but that's really not quite there yet. It's mostly gasoline or maybe diesel. All right, so my pointer is going away. Let me get my pointer straightened out. Oh, no. I did the wrong one. Pointer. Is that pointer options?
Yeah.
There we go. It's through the projector. Okay. So how much ATP as humans do we need? We need a lot. Okay. So let's think about different ways we can appreciate what a lot really means. All right. So we said that these mitochondria require oxygen to make ATP. And every once in a while, somebody's heart is going to stop. And when their heart stops, what happens to blood flow in their body? It stops. So there's no oxygen being delivered anywhere, including the brain. But your brain needs ATP to stay alive and to maintain consciousness. When your heart stops, how long or how much ATP is in your brain before it gets used up, before you pass out? How fast does your brain use up all the ATP, or so much that it passes out when your heart stops? How long can you maintain, maybe I'll say it even a better way. How long can you maintain consciousness after your heart stops before your brain runs out of ATP? Is it like a week or? Okay. That's really close. It's actually 3 seconds. 3 seconds. So when somebody's heart stops, they kind of have a weird feeling and they're passed out already, right? Just within 3 seconds. Because enough ATP is used up, those cells stop functioning. They can't transmit electrical activity, action potentials, all right? But they're still using ATP. After what period of time do those brain cells actually die? And of course, when they die, what does that mean? When something's dead, you can't start it up again. It's not like starting a car or something, jump starting a car. When the brain is dead, you can't get it back again. After what period of time, if breathing is not reestablished, does somebody's brain actually die? 3 seconds, you're unconscious, and 3 minutes is when the brain actually dies. So that's a really short period of time, in my feeling. So that's how much ATP the brain requires, and your heart and other highly metabolic organs are pretty much the same. Like your kidneys require a lot of ATP as well. So that's quite a lot. So in terms of your overall body mass, if an average person is about 70 kilograms, your body needs to hydrolyze about 40 kilograms of ATP every day. That's about half your body weight gets burned up. That's a tremendous amount of ATP. So the job that these mitochondria are doing is really phenomenal because it's keeping us alive. All right, some other organelles that we see in this picture right here. Something your book calls agranular endoplasmic reticulum. Pretty much every other book in the world would call this smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And it's smooth because it's just a membrane system, as opposed to this kind of endoplasmic reticulum over here. We call this rough endoplasmic reticulum. Your book says granular, that's fine with me. All right, but the granular endoplasmic reticulum has an additional little organelle on it, ribosomes. And ribosomes are the workbench for protein synthesis. In order for this cell to make a protein, it's got to have a ribosome. So the function of rough ER is to make proteins or protein synthesis. The function of smooth endoplasmic reticulum is lipid synthesis. Now give me the name of one of your favorite lipids. Steroids might be good. Phospholipid, yeah, cholesterol, phospholipid, all these things smooth endoplasmic reticulum makes. All right, so here are the centrioles. Here and here, they organize the microtubule system. And there is something else over here, the Golgi complex or Golgi apparatus, Golgi body. Sometimes it goes by any one of these names. The Golgi body can take material that was built in the rough endoplasmic reticulum, for example. What kind of material is that? Proteins. In the rough ER, the proteins are packaged in vesicles. I see some little vesicles over here, and they move over to the Golgi body. How do they get over to the Golgi body? They take a microtubule system over there. Sometimes they move by diffusion, but they can be directed by microtubules. And these little vesicles can fuse with the Golgi apparatus, and what was ever inside this vesicle, namely these proteins from the rough ER, end up inside the Golgi apparatus in this membrane right here. And there, they are modified. They can be conjugated with other kinds of molecules, like a carbohydrate or even a lipid. So they'll become a molecule with a couple different natures, maybe part polysaccharide and part protein. So we call that a mucopolysaccharide. And so it's modified. So one job of the Golgi is to modify proteins, modify them. And then, after they're modified, you see the Golgi apparatus kind of pinching off right here. So this has a modified product in it, maybe a mucopolysaccharide, and it pinches off and it forms a vesicle. So now the product of the rough ER and Golgi body end up inside this vesicle, and the vesicle then is brought over to the plasma membrane, and it fuses to the plasma membrane, and whatever was inside this vesicle right here now ends up outside the cell. So this is what we call a secretory pathway, where it starts with material being made in the rough ER that's given to the Golgi for modification and packaging into a secretory vesicle for export outside the cell. You might see some other ribosomes. Here's a ribosome right here. That's a free ribosome in the cytoplasm. What's the function of this ribosome right here? I didn't tell you specifically, but you should know. The function of this ribosome is for protein synthesis. That's the workbench where proteins are made. Right. What does this ribosome need to make a protein? What's a building block? Amino acid, right? Amino acid. So this ribosome gets amino acids. We'll put them together according to specific rules. And the proteins that this free ribosome make end up in the cytosol, just dissolved in the cytosol. They're not exported. However, the proteins made by the rough ER are destined to do what? To be secreted. So depending on where a protein is made, whether it's a ribosome in the cytosol or on the rough ER, its fate is different. It either stays inside the cell or is secreted from the cell. What else do we see? We got some other vesicles. Here is a lysosome. A lysosome contains digestive enzymes. And that digestive enzyme is called lysozyme. Lysozyme. And it just digests big macromolecules down. And so if a bacteria gets through the plasma membrane, tries to infect this cell right here, this lysosome might fuse with it and surround the bacteria, and lysozyme will digest the bacteria. And then what happens to the bacteria? Well, it's dead because it's all digested. Okay? And then the cell can use those basic building blocks for its own purposes, like if the amino acids it can make proteins out of. Glycerol can be used to make what? Triglycerides, right? Okay. And the nucleotides can be used to make RNA and DNA. Okay. So that's a lysosome. Another kind of vesicle, which I don't see necessarily on this slide, it might be on here someplace, is called a peroxisome. But I think you have this in your book someplace. A peroxisome doesn't contain lysozyme. It contains something called peroxidase. And peroxidase is an enzyme that can take a fairly toxic byproduct of cellular metabolism, which is toxic to the cell, and it is this guy. What does that look like?
Water,
but it's not quite that, it's this. That's called hydrogen peroxide. So for every hydrogen, there's an oxygen. That's what the name means, hydrogen peroxide. So since there's two hydrogens, there's two oxygens attached to it. You have this laying around your house probably, okay? And if you pour it on yourself, is it like pouring water or is it reactive? Really reactive, right? That's why it's toxic when it gets inside cells. And peroxidase will break this down into H2O, which doesn't bubble when you pour it on yourself, but also oxygen. I didn't balance this equation. All right, so this is toxic, and is water toxic to your cells? No, and neither is oxygen under normal circumstances. So peroxisomes will break down this byproduct into non-harmful chemicals. And, of course, we have a lot of peroxidase all over our bodies. So when you cut yourself, right, that enzyme gets busy, and when you pour peroxide, hydrogen peroxide on yourself, it breaks down into oxygen. And this oxygen is, when this happens, it's really good because this water irrigates the wound, it flushes out bacteria, right? And also, it produces a lot of oxygen, and there are a lot of bacteria that that find oxygen to be toxic. So it's nice to clean wounds out with hydrogen peroxide for that. Two of those reasons. Okay. Okay, so here is the nucleus. And so there's a nice big membrane system, and inside the nucleus we have DNA, which makes chromosomes. And the chromosomes contain the blueprint on how to make all of these proteins inside the cell, how to put them together. So the chromosomes or the genes in these chromosomes are like the blueprint for how to make the cell. But more than that, right? So when we said it contains information how to build the cell, would that be anatomy or physiology? How to build something. That would be anatomy. That's just structure, right? But some proteins inside the cell are enzymes. They have functions associated with them. So when the nucleus builds enzymes, it is also controlling what? Not just the structure of the cell, but also the physiology of the cell, the function of the cell. So the nucleus is actually controlling what, both the anatomy and the physiology of this cell. So that's real important information. And that's why it is put in the nucleus, because the nucleus protects DNA from becoming damaged or corrupted. Because what would happen to this cell, the functioning and even the structure of this cell, if the DNA got lost or corrupted or something? The cell would die, right? So the purpose of the nuclear envelope that surrounds these chromosomes right here is to protect the DNA so nothing happens to it, so that it's damaged, so it does not get damaged. All right, this area right here, the nucleolus. Anybody know what the nucleolus is? It's inside the nucleus. It's a little dark area. Okay. Well, let me tell you a little bit about it. Okay. So we have information inside the nucleus on how to build the cell and how to control the cell. But that information is locked inside the nucleus. It has to get into the cytoplasm because that's where we make proteins. Where are the two places we make proteins? Rough ER and free ribosomes. So that information in the DNA has to get out into the cytoplasm to work with rough ER and ribosomes. But the DNA doesn't leave. The information is converted into something else first. It's converted into RNA. And that RNA is made in the nucleolus. So the nucleolus is the most active part of the nucleus where RNA is being made. And then what does that RNA do? Leaves the nucleus, goes into the cytoplasm, where it starts to make proteins. All right, so we said, if the DNA gets damaged, what happens to the cell? It dies. That's a bad thing. What happens if the RNA gets damaged when it gets into the cytoplasm right here? Is that a really horrendous thing? That's really not too bad, because the cell can say, oh, I've lost that RNA, but that's okay, because that information is still contained in the DNA, and I can just make some more DNA, and that's fine. We can do that. So the way that I think of the nucleus is like it's a part of the library. Okay, so if you go over to our library, there are books that you can check out and walk around, right, town with. But there's a certain part of the library where you can get those books. They'll give them to you, but they don't ever let you take them out of the library. What part of the library is that? I used to put my lectures in there. It's called the reserve section of the library. And I have this textbook. I have a couple copies of your textbook and probably the lab manual in the reserve section. All right, so I think of the nucleus as being like the reserve section where you can get at that information, but it's protected. It doesn't get lost. So you put stuff in the reserve section that you don't want to have to replace. You might not be able to replace it, you know, like the Magna Carta or something. It's in a safe part of the library that you can't get damaged in. That's the nucleus. Okay. All right, so let me see what's on the next slide. Lysosomes. Oh, yeah. Lysosomes contain what? Digestive enzymes, lysozyme. So sometimes cells are programmed to die. These lysosomes break open, and what happens to the cell? It gets digested from the inside out. So clinically speaking, it's pretty important to know something about all these different organelles. Mitochondria, that's obvious. All right, but what about these lysosomes? They contain dangerous digestive enzymes. And when a cell runs out of ATP, all of the membranes start to get unstable and they start to leak. Right? So when somebody's having a heart attack, there isn't oxygen getting to some parts of the heart. This lysosome is going to start to leak digestive enzymes. And so the heart then, from the inside, will start to digest itself. That's really bad for patients. So it'd be nice to come up with a drug that will prevent these lysosomes from breaking open and getting leaky. And there are such things. Those are corticosteroids. So when somebody's having a stroke or a heart attack, they're actually given a little bit of corticosteroid to do what? To maintain the integrity of all the membranes, but especially these lysosomes right here. That prevents a lot of internal damage to all those myocardial cells. Right, so all of these organelles are real important in medicine. Peroxisomes for detoxification. Yeah, we said that. Mitochondria, we said make ATP. They require, what do they require?
Energy.
They are making energy for the cell.
Well,
They are making energy for the cell. They need oxygen to do that. We're going to get into a lot of particulars in terms of the mitochondria later on. But they do need a little input. They need glucose as an input of energy, but they also need oxygen. And you can see that there are membranes within membranes in mitochondria. This is the outer mitochondrial membrane, and the inner one has a lot of folds. These folds are what we call Christi. And the space that's on the inside of the Christi is what we call the matrix. That's inside the inner mitochondrial membrane. So we're going to learn what all these different functions of the membrane do. Ribosomes, right? That's the workbench for protein synthesis. And it's actually made out of RNA. A couple different subunits of RNA come together to form a ribosome. And the interesting thing about this ribosome is look at this thing right here. It has a tunnel going right through the middle of it. And we're going to see what that tunnel is important for in just a little bit. Okay, so this actually kind of looks like a big sphere right here is what? That little tiny dot we saw on the picture. So here are all these ribosomes. This is a nice electron micrograph of, what is this a micrograph of? Yeah, what kind of endoplasmic reticulum? Yeah, the rough one. For what kind of function? Protein synthesis. So here's a nice illustration of the same thing. And then here's smooth ER for lipid synthesis. Here is that nice secretory pathway that I was talking about. Proteins are made in the rough ER. They move via vesicle to the Golgi apparatus where they're modified and packaged into vesicles for secretion, for instance. And here's that nucleus, the nuclear envelope. Right here, here's the active part of the nucleus. And within the nuclear envelope, there are pores for chemical compounds to leave. Like, for instance, RNA can leave the nucleus through these pores. But these pores are small enough to keep the DNA inside the nucleus. Okay. Well, all right, let's talk about these organelles. We had all these organelles. So you should have a really nice, bullet point, one or two word description for each one of these organelles. Like mitochondria is for ATP production. And Golgi, what's a Golgi apparatus for?
Modifying
and packaging. And smooth ER is for lipid synthesis. I should make a nice flash quiz with these. Maybe I do have one. Okay. Lysosome is for digestion. Peroxisome is for detoxification. So those should all be on the tip of your tongue, right, for every organelle. But what? How come cells have organelles? Let's look at the big picture now. Why does a cell have all these different organelles? I'll take one at a time, yeah?
To sustain life.
But why can't life just happen inside a cell without organelles? With all its parts. It needs all those parts. Yeah, you don't want to take like the engine out of a car because it would be a pretty cool car. You could play the radio and all that stuff, but you couldn't drive anywhere. All right. But, I don't know. Does anybody else have an idea? Yeah, each one of those structures, right, has a different function associated with it. So again, there's nice structural functional relationship even at the organelle level. So in a cell, let's think of a cell as this building that we're in right now, okay? And what's happening inside this building? We're learning because our brains like to learn more than anything else, okay? There is what? There's a physiology class going on. There's math classes going on. The dean is doing paperwork over there, right? And then there's somebody in the stock room mixing chemicals, and there's a math class and a lot of chemistry classes going on. Well, what if this building was just one big room? What would happen with maybe 40 different classes going on at the same time? Maybe I wasn't the only lecturer. Maybe there was a chemistry and a physics and a math teacher and a couple of them all lecturing to that one classroom. What would that be like?
Yeah.
Mass confusion, right? And I wouldn't even know what I was saying probably because I'd be listening to everybody else at the same time, right? So we put different rooms in a building so that you can perform different functions without interference from other functions that are going on. So organelles do the same thing. They're specialized to produce a certain kind of function. And they do it in such a way that they don't interfere with other important functions that are going on inside the cell. And if it was all mixed together, there would be interference between these different functions, and the cell just wouldn't, probably wouldn't live, right? Or at the same level. So that's real important to know. Specialized functions by specialized what? It's a real important concept I want you to match up. Specialized functions because of specialized structures. So there's always a nice relationship between structure and function in biology. Okay. Gene expression. So we said that genes are found in DNA. Yeah, they're a chemical set of instructions on how to make a protein. And remember, proteins can be structural or functional. They're both anatomy and physiology. And where do we have DNA? It's in the nucleus, right? Because DNA makes chromosomes, and that's always inside the nucleus unless the cell is going to be dividing by a process we call mitosis. Okay. So this is the precious information that we don't ever want to get lost. And that has to be converted into RNA. And this happens, where in the cell does this happen? Where does DNA get converted into RNA? Yeah, it's in the nucleus. Maybe I'll say it a little bit better. Where is not DNA converted into RNA, but where is the information that's contained in DNA converted into the information in RNA? That's in the nucleus, and in particular, the active part of the nucleus is the nucleolus. Yeah, you're right. That's the nucleolus, right? So that's where RNA is being made. And then that RNA can leave the nucleus. It's transported out through the nuclear membrane. And then the information that's in that RNA, that's in the cytoplasm, is used to make a protein. So a protein contains information in it as well. So we see how many step process does it take to make a protein? How many arrows do you see? You see two arrows right here. And they have specific names. Something else you could tell me about these arrows. Is it a one-way arrow or a two-way arrow? It's one-way. Right? So this is what we call the central dogma of biology, and dogma just means, you know, something that is to be believed and never challenged and is always true. And that's what we learned a long time ago, and you'll see in this class it's not really true, but this is a good place to start nonetheless. Okay? So in order to make a protein, the information has to come from DNA. Information in a protein can never go backwards and be incorporated into RNA, and that can never be incorporated into information in DNA. And I kind of say in a little bit of a silly way that that's really good. Why is that a really good idea? Why is this really beneficial to us? That proteins can never go back and change your DNA. Why is that? Yeah, you'd be changing all the time. Tonight, for instance, if you were to go home and have a chicken dinner or something, you don't have to worry about waking up with a beak and feathers, right? Because those proteins aren't going to change your DNA at all. Your DNA is invariant, right? Okay, well, that's a little silly, but not too bad. The big thing that I just really want you to remember is what? DNA directs the production of proteins. Proteins don't direct the production in DNA. Okay. So protein synthesis, we saw, was a two-step process, right? DNA to RNA is one. RNA to protein is the second one. And you should know where these two take place. Yeah?
I have a quick question. So the book, it says that rRNA is made in the nucleolus, but tRNA and mRNA are made somewhere else inside the nucleus, not the nucleolus.
Okay, the best way of saying that, to maybe take that into account, is that the nucleolus is the most active part of the nucleus. And I think, yeah, that's a nice distinction that you're making there. But I would say, you know, nucleolus, that's the busiest place. Okay, and what's happening is the information in DNA is being converted into RNA. And this first step is what we call transcription. So where does this occur? It's got to be in the nucleus because, it's got to be in the nucleus because the DNA never leaves the nucleus. Okay, so what is a gene? A gene is a sequence of nucleotides, because that's a building block of what? A nucleic acid, right? A nucleotide is a building block of some kind of nucleic acid. So that's just a chemical set of instructions for making some kind of protein, some specific protein. All right, we call this transcription. Now you can memorize this, or maybe you can understand a little bit about this process right here. What's the building block of DNA? A nucleotide. In particular, what does this D stand for? The deoxyribonucleotide, which you have a picture of. All right, and what's the building block of RNA? It's a nucleotide as well, but modified a little bit differently because it's what? It's made with a ribosugar. It has that oxygen in that one position. So DNA and RNA have basically the same or very similar building blocks. Right? So if I could ask you, what's, in a general sense, what's a building block of DNA? You'd say nucleotide. What's a building block of RNA? You could say nucleotide. You know, if you want to be more particular and say ribonucleotide versus deoxyribonucleotide, that would be great, but they're what? They're all just nucleotides. So what I want you to appreciate is that the language of DNA is a nucleotide language. The language of RNA is what? It's a nucleotide language. So they're basically the same. So, for instance, what do you call that? What do you call it when you want to get a copy of your grades at maybe Cypress College here? A transcript. And what is a transcript? What does it look like? It looks like an exact copy, like a photocopy. Right? That's what we do now with a photocopy machine. You photocopy something, it's an exact duplicate, and that's a transcript. So we call this transcription because DNA and RNA basically have the same building blocks. It's the same language. It's just taking information and copying it from one molecule to another using the same language, which is nucleotide language. All right, then the RNA leaves the nucleus and it goes into the cytoplasm. All right, and so then the information in RNA is used to make a protein. What's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. Is that different than nucleotide? All right, when you look at those pictures, they're really different looking kinds of molecules. So you're going from an RNA language or nucleotide language to what? An amino acid language. What do you call that process of going from one language to another? That's translation, right? When you go to German to Irish or something, right? Or English to Farsi or whatever language. That's translation. Now, where does this translation take place? Not in the nucleus. That's transcription. Translation happens in the cytoplasm, never in the nucleoplasm. Okay, so what determines the sequence of amino acids in a protein is the sequence of nucleotides in a messenger RNA. Does anybody want to go over these definitions anymore? You got them? Where they take place? Why you call them what they call them? Okay, so it's a, don't forget, two-step process. All right, so genes are lengths of DNA that code for the synthesis of RNA. What do we call that process? DNA being converted into RNA. That's transcription. Yeah, where does it happen? Yeah, nucleus, all right, because DNA never leaves the nucleus. All right, then the messenger RNA carries information on how to make a protein. It's transported out of the nucleus to ribosomes, where proteins are made. And ribosomes are even made out of a kind of RNA, but not messenger RNA. It's made out of what we call ribosomal RNA, or little r, capital RNA. Okay, so we talked about this already. Oh, well, here's something interesting with this kind of cells that we have. Not all cells do this. Each nucleus contains one or more dark areas we call the nucleolus. Right, these contain genes actively making ribosomal RNA. So if we look at all of the genes that are contained in chromosomes, we call that the genome. All the possible genes that are contained within a nucleus is what we call a genome. And what do these genes make? These genes make proteins. So we can look at all the genes that are inside of a cell, but we could also look at their product. And the product of all these different genes are what we call the proteome. So it's a little bit different way of thinking of one is what? Just the blueprint, and one is the actual product. And for years and years and years, we used to think that for every protein that was made, it was made due to one gene. So there was a one-to-one correspondence. And in some cells, that's probably true, maybe like bacteria. But in human cells, one gene might actually be able to make a number of different kinds of proteins depending on how that information is processed. Okay, so let's look at some structure of DNA just a little bit. So what do I see way over here? I see a phosphate and a sugar and a phosphate and a sugar. So if I were to circle this area right here, what is that? Yeah, that's a building block of DNA, right? That's a building block of DNA. So what's a building block of DNA? That's a deoxyribonucleic acid. So here's just one nucleic acid. Here's another one. And another one and another one. And then here it's illustrated at being different nucleotides. So DNA, and I think we've looked at this, DNA is always double-stranded. The bases are toward the inside of the double helix. Right, and the handrails are always phosphate, sugar, the bases are pointing to the inside. So there's a particular sequence of bases on the inside of this DNA molecule. That's just the primary structure. And did I tell you what the nucleotides are in DNA? Yeah, GC and AT, okay, for DNA. Okay, well, when DNA is not being used, it's packaged, it's safe. It's packaged in a chromosome like this. Okay, and when it's packaged in this chromosome, it's very safe, so the nuclear envelope can even break down and disappear, for instance, during mitosis. So this is a safe way of carrying the DNA. But when the DNA is going to be used to make RNA, all of these strands have to be pulled off of this chromosome and take this form right here to get at that information. When the chromatin is pulled off, or these strands of DNA are pulled off of a chromosome, it's easy to damage them. So the nuclear envelope never disappears when the DNA is being used. Okay, when it's not being used, these strands of DNA are wrapped around these proteins right here that we call histones. So these are little spools. So histones, you could think of as spools, and DNA is wrapped around, and then spools are packaged on top of each other. So then this thing right here we would call a nucleosome. So when DNA is on a nucleosome, is it safe or is it unprotected? Here is unprotected. When it's on a nucleosome, it's protected from damage. Right? So that's one nice, that's why DNA is wrapped around these nucleosomes. All right, so a lot of times when we see a cell, we don't see chromosomes. The nucleus looks pretty homogeneous, except for the nucleolus. That kind of chromatin, we say, is extended chromatin. It's pulled off of a chromosome. It's being used to make RNA. But when it's packaged on a chromosome, wrapped around all these histones right here, we say that it is condensed. So condensed chromatin is tightly packaged. Extended chromatin is open for being used. One is damageable and the other is relatively safe. Extended chromatin is kind of in a precarious position, but it's protected. Why? How is extended chromatin protected? Extended is out over here. So here's extended. It's away from the histones. What protects extended chromatin is the nuclear envelope, right? You never see this outside the nucleus. Okay. All right, so euchromatin, that's a different way of talking about it. I don't know if I have any questions on the test regarding this or any on the web or not, but euchromatin is the part of the chromosome that's active in transcription, so it's extended. Heterochromatin is highly condensed region where genes are inactivated and it's protected, so this would be condensed. Okay. All right, so here is a part of a chromosome right here. How do we get from condensed chromatin, see condensed chromatin, tightly packaged with all these histones? We need to get at the information for transcription. And the way that cells do this is by acetylation. So another little chemical is bound, right, to this condensed chromatin, and it starts to unwind itself through this process of acetylation. So when it's acetylated, chromatin becomes extended, and it reveals parts of the DNA molecule. And for instance, in this part right here, transcription can begin. So this is going to be the region that's going to be transcribed. And what does transcription mean? Converting the information in this DNA into RNA, right? So here is a sequence of nucleotides in DNA. It's going to be converted into a sequence of nucleotides in RNA. All right, and if we were to look at one of the previous slides, we see that there are some base pairing rules, right? Bases always pair up, and in DNA, the base pairing rules are always GC and AT. That's not going to be so for RNA. Okay. So one gene codes for one polypeptide chain, and we don't really know any longer believe that that's necessarily true. Sometimes one gene can code for more than one protein, and we're going to see how that happens in just a little bit. And each gene is maybe several thousand nucleotide pairs long. All right, so how does RNA synthesis get started? For transcription, that's the first part, right? There is an enzyme. Remember, when you see ASE at the end of the word, that means it's an enzyme. There is an enzyme that's going to make a polymer. So a polymerase is an enzyme that can make a polymer. And what is a polymer? It's a molecule that is made up of mostly identical subunits repeating itself time and time again, maybe thousands of times. So you could think of that molecule as being made of building blocks. So for RNA, what are the building blocks of RNA? Those would be the ribonucleotides. So if you have different ribonucleotides, they're put together via that dehydration synthesis reaction by RNA polymerase. RNA polymerase is the enzyme necessary to put ribonucleotides together to make RNA. Okay, so this RNA polymerase has to bind to a start sequence on the DNA molecule. And when that happens, the DNA molecule starts to separate. It unzips because, don't forget, DNA is double-stranded. The strands can come apart. Now, do you think that's difficult to get the strands to come apart? What kind of bonds are holding the strands together? I think we looked at that. Those are hydrogen bonds. And what's the relative strength of a hydrogen bond? Relatively weak. So it's relatively easy to unzip the DNA molecule and to zip it back up again because the hydrogen bonds are relatively weak. So DNA polymerase starts to unzip the DNA strands. There are other regions in the DNA which we call promoter regions which can regulate transcription. So these genes can be controlled. They can be used or not used depending on whether other molecules will bind to these promoter regions. Furthermore, there are transcription factors, right, that have to bind to these promoter regions to start transcription. So you might need a specific hormone to start transcription for a particular process, and that hormone might be a transcription factor that binds to a promoter region on DNA to start protein synthesis that could not happen otherwise. All right, so what do we have on this picture right here? Well, here is a double-stranded nucleic acid. And a double-stranded nucleic acid is always going to be DNA, right? It's going to be DNA. But in order to get at the information in DNA, it can't be a double strand. It has to be what? It's got to be unzipped. It's got to be single strand because, remember, what's the primary sequence of a protein again? What does that mean, primary sequence of a protein? It is just the sequence of amino acids. What amino acid comes next to which one in a protein? Well, there's a primary sequence in DNA as well. What's the primary sequence of this DNA right here? Let's start with this one. This is G, C, I can't see it, A, G, A, C, T. This is the primary sequence of DNA, and that's going to determine the primary sequence of amino acids in a protein. Okay, so when we look at how RNA is made. Okay, we see base pairing rules for DNA. So for every T you have an A, and for every G you've got a C, right? But the base pairing rules are a little bit different when the sequence is copied into RNA. And the base pair rules are going to be, now this is the same as DNA, guanine will pair with cytosine, adenine will pair with uracil in RNA instead of thymine. Right, so over here in the DNA molecule, do you see any uracils? No. What do you see? What's gonna base pair with this adenine in DNA? It's gonna be thymine, right? But in RNA, what pairs with adenine right here is this one right here, uracil. Oh, here's another one. Here's an adenine, and what is this strand? Is this the DNA strand or the RNA strand? That's the DNA strand. There's an adenine. That means that RNA polymerase is going to put in a uracil right here instead of a thymine. So the difference between RNA and DNA is very small. Just that one little oxygen atom in the nucleotide, and you have uracil instead of thymine. And this is a big, long sequence of nucleotides. And that's what's going to go into the cytoplasm to determine the sequence of amino acids that are going to make the protein. So this is the primary sequence of the, what we call the message. So this is a messenger RNA that will go out to the cytoplasm. So what does transcription make? Well, it makes RNA. We've got a couple different kinds of RNA. We've got ribosomal RNA, which makes... What does our ribosomal RNA make? It just makes a structure that makes a ribosome. That's the workbench for translation, or the workbench for protein synthesis. And in order for a ribosome to make a protein, it needs to get building blocks. What are the building blocks of a protein? Amino acids. So a ribosome is pretty much stationary inside the cell. Amino acids have to come to it to get incorporated into the protein that's being made. But there's a special molecule that brings amino acids to the ribosome to be put into a protein, and that's what we call the transfer RNA. Right? Sometimes I call those taxi RNAs, because what are they taxiing around inside the cell? Amino acids that are going to be put into a protein. So that's a transfer RNA. And then the last RNA that's needed for protein synthesis is the actual message. This contains the code for synthesis of a protein. The primary sequence of nucleotides and messenger RNA will determine the primary sequence of amino acids in a protein. And we're going to see how that happens in just a little bit. Okay, now this pre-mRNA is a precursor form of messenger RNA. When messenger RNA is made, or this precursor messenger RNA is made, there are parts of that RNA molecule that don't mean anything as far as we know with our level of understanding now on how to make that protein. So these are segments that have to be thrown away, cut out and thrown away. And then that molecule is put back together to make the actual messenger RNA that makes a protein. So let's look at a pre-messenger RNA, and actually a couple steps right here. And let's start here next time as well, but let's look at it briefly tonight anyway. So we have DNA, right? We have genes on this DNA. Where do we find this DNA at? In the nucleus, okay? And we want to convert this information of DNA into RNA. What's that process called? Transcription. And that happens in the nucleus, right? Then that messenger RNA, all right, has to leave to bind to a ribosome to make a protein on a ribosome. But before that happens, look at these different areas on this messenger RNA. There's some light areas here and some dark areas. And I presume they're pretty much the same color, they're just lighter. These light areas are what we call exons. These dark areas are what we call introns. And those are all just matching sequences that we find in DNA. But before we can make a protein from this pre-messenger RNA, these dark areas right here have to be cut out. and the light areas have to be spliced together. So the areas that actually are used to make a protein come from this exon region, and these areas right here that don't code for a protein are what we call introns. And that's something special of the kinds of cells that we have. Not all cells have this, but mammalian cells have this, plants have these kinds of things, but simple organisms like yeast and bacteria don't have these introns and exons. So inside the nucleus, pre-messenger RNA is modified to make a competent messenger RNA, which then leaves the nucleus, and that's going to direct translation inside the nucleus. So don't forget, the introns are the parts that are, as far as we know today, are just thrown away. They're not used. And it's the exons that are used to make up protein. But we're probably going to find some place where these introns are very important. And in maybe 5 or 10 years, you're going to find, well, these introns are misbehaving, causing a certain disease process or something, and we might have to deal with these pharmacologically or something. But right now, we don't really know what they're used for. Okay. So let me start with that slide on Thursday once again. Okay? Okay. Any questions at all? Start mousing around on the web, find your materials.